From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm your host, Kimberly Izar. It is Saturday, April 18th, and it is also our first hour-long show. That means, yes, that Farm and Country is going to be from 10 to 11 a.m. now. That means more stories and more time with you. Today, we are kicking off not one, but two special series, one with Edible Hudson Valley. We chat with Todd Spire, editor-in-chief, about what's in store for the spring issue. And we also kick off a partnership with the Watershed Agricultural Council and their Buy Local campaign. Ronald Kelson chats with Kristen Morley about the organization and the farmers across the Catskills we'll be highlighting. Plus, a group of farmers in Delaware County is transforming a 287-acre farm into a community land trust. And Rosie Starr visits the Tustin Heritage Community Garden. But first, news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The Iranian military is carrying out attacks on tanker ships in the Strait of Hormuz hours after reimposing restrictions in the waterway. The announcement came the morning after President Trump said an American blockade would remain until a peace agreement with Tehran is reached. There's no word on when negotiations between the two sides will resume, with a ceasefire set to expire next week. NPR's Kat Lonsdorf reports from Beirut.
Iran reversed course Saturday after announcing Friday that it would open the strait for commercial vessels during its ceasefire with the U.S. and Israel. It accused the U.S. of violating the deal. Iran's military said that control of the strait has, quote, returned to its previous state under strict management and control of the armed forces. It said it would remain this way as long as the U.S. blockade on Iranian ports continued. The ceasefire deal between the U.S., Israel, and Iran is set to expire early next week. On Friday night, Trump said that attacks on Iran could resume if no deal is reached. Meanwhile, a 10-day ceasefire is in effect to pause the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, something Iran required in order to continue talks with the U.S. Kat Lonsdorf, NPR News, Beirut.
Air Canada says it's suspending some flights to New York this summer. Dan Karpinchuk reports the conflict in Iran is making certain routes unprofitable.
The decision over rising jet fuel prices will affect flights from Toronto and Montreal to New York's John F. Kennedy International Airport from June 1st to the end of October. Air Canada says jet fuel prices have doubled since the beginning of the Iran conflict and it no longer makes sense economically to continue some routes. Affected customers will be contacted with alternate travel options such as flying to LaGuardia and Newark Liberty daily from six Canadian cities. Aviation experts say the jet fuel crisis is getting serious and airlines will have to consolidate their routes. Some are already passing on fuel price increases to their customers. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
President Trump signed an executive order at the White House this morning expanding access to a psychedelic drug that's used to treat post-traumatic stress disorder.
Today, the federal government is making a $50 million research investment in its own, and so that was just approved just last night. We're also opening a pathway for Ibogaine to be administered to desperately ill patients under the Right to Try law. That's a law that I started and I got Right to Try.
The drug Ibogaine has been explored as a treatment for addiction, depression, and anxiety, but it remains illegal in the United States. There was a study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2025. It showed that a single dose of the psychedelic LSD could ease anxiety and depression for months. You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Kimberly Izar. Livingston Manor sits at the heart of several fishing streams and waterways, where there's been a history of flooding since the 1960s. Town of Rockland supervisor Rob Eggleton says the impact of flooding has been devastating.
We actually had a loss of life on one of the floods we had from the Cattail Brook. And every time it floods, downtown area is the area that gets it right away quick. So whatever we can do to try to eliminate that flooding is going to be proactive for everyone in the community, especially the business people.
Livingston Manor and nonprofit Trout Unlimited were recently awarded a $4.7 million grant from the state's Department of Environmental Conservation to reconnect the Willowemaw Creek with 11 acres of its historic floodplain. Emily Perkins, an engineer with Redfish Engineering, says the existing beams only protect the area against minor flooding.
However, during larger storm events, those berms overtop and they actually can constrain the flows in larger storm events, causing those floodwaters to back up.
The project would require relocating the school district's athletic fields, which some school board members say could be expensive. But Perkins says it would reduce flooding on Main Street by as much as 3 feet.
It removes homes and businesses and utilities, critical infrastructure, from the floodplain. This is a conceptual design, and if at any point we find that the design needs to be tweaked, that's what we're doing as part of phase one.
The state awarded the grant as part of its effort to mitigate flooding across New York. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, as we said at the top of the hour, Farm and Country is officially now a full hour-long show. This is so extremely exciting for me and our producer, Ronald Kelson, and really the whole team here at Radio Catskill, because it means that we get to bring in new voices and more stories for you, our listeners. We have a really large region here in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania. And expanding the show also means that we get to bring in news partners who help us cover the areas that we can't reach. We can't do it alone. And I'm really excited to share about our new series with Edible Hudson Valley. Joining me now is Todd Spire. He's Edible Hudson Valley's editor-in-chief. Edible Hudson Valley explores our region through the stories of food, drink, and the people behind it. Todd, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You know, Todd, I was especially really excited to hop into conversation with you because this is, you know, the first of our monthly series that hopefully we'll be doing here on Farm and Country, where we talk about what's happening at Edible Hudson Valley, but then also the many different hats and projects that you wear and you're working on, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But for our listeners who might not be super familiar with Edible Hudson Valley, tell me a little bit about the publication and the different areas and stories that you work on.
Yeah, sure. So Edible is actually a national sort of platform for regional publishing. The magazine focuses on food systems, and it makes the Hudson Valley in particular a perfect fit for the mission-based editorial that Edible Communities likes to try and provide to its readers. We are the largest edible franchise holder in the country. So my company actually owns 4 franchises. We have Manhattan, Brooklyn, Westchester, and the Hudson Valley, which includes the Catskills, where we're located, which provides us with this pretty incredible ability to see the entire region and report on the entire region in strategically different ways that makes our whole unique food system of the Hudson Valley just that much better. I like to talk about the various roles, and there's overlap, but I like to say that the downstate issues are really about sort of setting what's cool in food, and the upstate issues tend to be, not that we're not creating phenomenally cool food experiences as well, but we're a big part of the production of that, which is obviously everything from the dirt to the climate to the people and the farms that sustain our full regional food system. I think we are very spoiled, and I think we fall into that almost that echo chamber in a way where we tend to forget how lucky we are to have the food, to have the access to fresh food from farms and produce, makers that are setting their own standards so incredibly high that it's the barrier to entry to being a great food establishment in the Hudson Valley now is ultimately creates wonderful food experiences for everybody. And we get to report on those from the farm to the table. Not to be cliche, but it really is true.
I think what you said, being spoiled by truly absolutely. The beauty and the breadth that exists here in the Catskills. And I am so fortunate to live up here and see all the different ways and people that our food touch. Talk to me a little bit about some of the different people that you talk to.
It's one of the things that's been really nice to sort of return to doing media production within food. I worked for another food magazine in the Hudson Valley about a decade ago. And it becomes really wonderful when you see the invisible players that exist here. Sometimes it's in the world of just transportation of food. Sometimes it's in people supplying things to each other that otherwise wouldn't necessarily connect. There's a camaraderie across farms. So it might be one farm providing seeds to another farm so that they can produce a specialized produce for a particular restaurant. It's the kind of thing that you don't even get to report on that much because we tend to narrow our subject matter for the sake of just consumption, people's attention spans. I would love to write 6,000 word articles all the time, but we can't. We can't do that. And those little nuances that really connect all the systems together are kind of beautiful. I've been spending a lot of time talking with a group of Italian importers of really high-end food that are creating ingredients for local chefs that, while it breaks this idea of farm to table, it's actually creating just some of the best food you could possibly imagine because you're using the best ingredients. That company is called Poliani Select. They're importing really high-end oils and vinegars. It's stuff that they can't be produced here anyway. And it's an intricate part of making food. They're very rewarding stories.
Definitely. Yeah. And also just it's really endless. And I feel like I never stop learning, which is such a gift. I want to talk a little bit about this upcoming spring issue that is in the works for you and the team. I imagine that you probably can't talk too much about the specifics of the stories, but can you give a bit of a preview of what readers can potentially see?
Oh, absolutely. Our spring issue should be coming out in the next few weeks. I think around April 20th is our anticipated drop date. This issue's theme is travel. And how we wound up representing this theme, which we set in motion, you know, months ago in an editorial meeting, where we thought it would be about sort of a localized push to come out of the city and stay up in the Catskills or anywhere in the Hudson Valley, actually became sort of a tour of the world of cuisine. This is all the food cultures that we're touching on in the spring issue. Filipino food, Mexican food, Japanese food, Russian food. We travel to Lebanon, the American South, Korea, Italy, and Argentina.
Wow.
So we are really covering an enormous ground. And there are actually a few that are left off of that list because there's an article down in Manhattan that is covering an enormous number of restaurants. It's a really beautiful article. So you guys will see that. But it is so wonderful to, especially in the current state of the world, to say, you know, we're going to lead with all the cultures that are represented here in the Hudson Valley and the whole region and sort of double down on telling their stories.
Oh my goodness. I am not only getting hungry, hearing you talk through all the different cuisines around the world that folks can expect to read about, but also just I'm so excited to pick it up and hold it in my hands. I actually have the holiday guide, the holiday edition right here, which was just so fun to read. Before we shift gears a little bit, I just want to pause and see if you want to let folks know how they can find you.
Absolutely. You can find each of the issues under their regional name. So ediblehudsonvalley.com, Westchester, Brooklyn, Manhattan. Similarly, on all social media handles, you'll find us there. And we are sort of upping our weekly newsletter game right now, also in the Hudson Valley. So if you'd like to get updates on recipes, food events, and digital-only stories, please go to ediblehudsonvalley.com and subscribe.
All right, Todd, shifting gears a little bit, just because, you know, you wear a lot of different hats in the region. I know that you're involved quite a bit with, you know, conservation and fly fishing efforts. Tell me a little bit about just how you found yourself fly fishing in the Catskills.
Sure. Well, I am 19 years in the Catskills. So I like to refer to myself as old new school Catskills. I moved up when there was no Phoenicia Diner, speaking of the holiday issue, before there was anything really happening here, not anywhere near the scale that we've got now. And I was a lifelong angler and already addicted to fishing. And I came to the Catskills and had already known about the history of fly fishing here, realized that it would be sacrilegious to toss lures into these hollowed waters of the famous Catskills. So I took up fly fishing. And it really connected. It just connected with my brain in a very deep, deep way. When I landed in the Catskills, my soul was just so happy to use my time on the river as the footpath into coming into the rhythms of nature and the mountains here, the wildlife, the flora, the fauna, as they say. Everything that fly fishing allowed me to connect to outside of the river was in a way just as engaging to me and alluring to me, and brought me to sort of the place that I am now as an observer, as an angler, as a writer, as a nature writer, all of these things. And all of that certainly comes into play in my work, even back in publishing with Edible.
I mean, that's such a beautiful description of your beginnings. And then also, I loved hearing you talk about how it informs the rest of your work. When we were talking earlier about being spoiled here in the Catskills, I was down at Junction Pool for the first cast.
I actually saw that. I was very glad to see you there. That was beautiful. Yes.
On April 1st. It was so much fun. While I was there, I was talking to this, I think she's a seventh generation, 8-year-old fly fisher. You know, she was both excited, but also frustrated to be out in the waters. The waters were quite high and off-colored, like a little murky. I'm curious what tips you have for beginning fly fishers.
Well, one of the things that I do say, and we didn't even really talk about my experience as a guide, and obviously, you know, that's been an absolute pleasure. I've been guiding for 10 years. I always tell people to hire a guide. It doesn't have to be me, but you will not find success on your own. There are just too many moving parts to it. Go out with a guide your first time and then go flail around for 6 to 12 months and then hire a guide a second time to sort of refine your skills. There are an enormous number of skill sets, both mental knowledge skill sets, like just book knowledge, and then a whole new set of physical things that you need to learn how to do with your body. The rules of casting a fly rod break a lot of standard conceptions about how we use a rod. So without the help of a guide to really guide you through those first steps of knowledge, you'll just drop off. And in fact, I wrote a small piece for Escape Brooklyn's newsletter, which is coming out any day now. So if you want to get like a really nice cursory list of things to check out, you can go see it on their website.
We have been chatting with Todd Spire, Edible Hudson Valley's editor-in-chief. Todd, thank you so much for chatting today, and we'll catch you next month.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kimberly. Can't wait.
We'll take a short break, but when we come back, the latest from Keith Hubbard.
You showed up, and it made all the difference.
Thanks to our incredible listeners, Radio Catskill has met its fund drive goal.
That means more local stories, more community voices, and more of the programming you count on every day.
This station is powered by you, and because of you, it keeps growing stronger.
Thank you for being part of Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, you know what time it is? This week's Star Talk Report with Keith Hubbard.
For Farm and Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. The Lyrid meteor shower will be expected to reach its peak late Tuesday night and into Wednesday morning. In those hours, the constellation Lyra the Harp will be nearly directly overhead. Lyra will rise around 9 p.m., but it won't be until after midnight that the constellation will be high enough to offer good viewing opportunities. The Lyrid meteor shower occurs each year from about April 16th through the 25th. They are among the oldest known meteor showers, with records of the shower going back 2,700 years. The Lyrids are a modest meteor shower, producing 10 to 20 meteors an hour at its peak. Unlike other meteor showers, they are not a predictable shower, and at times they have produced up to 100 meteors per hour. The Lyrids are known to produce luminous trails, often lasting for several seconds. These trails are the result of ionized gas that continues to glow after the meteor has passed. The meteors are debris from Comet Thatcher. Comet Thatcher last graced our skies in 1861 on its 415-year journey around the sun. The waxing crescent moon will set around 1 a.m. Wednesday morning. This means that the moon will not be in the sky when the Lyrids reach their peak viewing time. The best opportunity to watch the Lyrid meteor shower will be early in the morning on Wednesday. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future StarTalk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and StarTalk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Now we're heading to Delaware County for this next story. More than one in three U.S. farmers is over the age of 65. As retiring farmers figure out what to do with their land, beginning farmers are trying to access affordable land. A group of farmers in Delaware County is transforming a 287-acre farm into a community land trust for beginning farmers. I spoke with farmers and advocates about the project. It's shoulder season in the Catskills, or the period in between late winter and summer when farmers are planting, seeding, and getting the ground ready for harvest. Farmer C. Matias looks out onto their farmland in Delancey, New York.
So we're currently looking at very winter-aged hay, lots of hay, beautiful mountainside on the edge of the West Branch of the Delaware River.
Their farm's name, Cerro Vida Farm, is an ode to Taino and Spanish languages and their grandmother.
Cerro being an Arawakan word for like an exchange, and vida is life, so an exchange of life, reciprocity and action, named after like my abuela Maria and the work that she did in her life. But yeah, we're a 3-acre diversified vegetable herb with a huge focus on Caribbean-based food. And that is something that I hold dear to myself, just like growing up in the city, going to different like mom and pop like fruit stands and vegetable stands and having access to very culturally relevant special foods that I feel like, you know, should be free and shouldn't have to travel far.
Matias grows crops like gandula beans, collard greens, and culantro herbs that they say everyone should have access to. They started the farm to grow food for mutual aid efforts, schools, and food pantries in the Bronx, Delaware, and Schoharie counties. But like many beginning farmers starting out, Matias had trouble finding affordable, long-term land to grow their food at scale. That's when they heard about a community land trust called West Branch Commons. Rhiannon Wright is the Land Access Program Manager with the Catskills Agrarian Alliance, who explained the project.
The National Young Farmers Coalition did some amazing census work with young farmers across the country a few years ago, and they found that land access is the number one issue for beginning farmers, and the cost of land is the number one reason why. The purpose of this is really to take this farm. We're going to be raising money as a collective to buy the farm, and we'll have it under a 501c3 nonprofit, and then we'll be making it available under long-term leases to beginning farmers. So it takes the need for those farmers to buy land out of the equation, allows them to, you know, focus more of their energy on actually doing the farming and, you know, less on the huge capital investment that it often takes to get going.
Wright says West Branch Commons can be a place much more than land to farm on.
There's a ton of opportunities for West Branch Commons to be like not just a place where farmers are farming long term, though that would be, you know, in and of itself a worthwhile endeavor. We're hoping that it really kind of behaves as like a incubation and training center for beginning farmers as well.
The project began with Tom Hudson, a fourth-generation dairy farmer who's 77. He's been farming his whole life and said the years just flew by.
I hadn't found anybody that was willing to put up with me and my workaholic habits and that sort of thing. I just kept doing it, and I looked around, and the years went by fast. I can't tell you how fast my life has gone. It was never really work. It was always a recreation right along with being work.
Before he knew it, it was time to retire. He wanted his farm, River Haven Farm, to continue being farmed, but he didn't have any family or children to transfer it to.
I had people come in, and some of them were local politicals and whatever, tell me what was going to happen to the farm. And my statement then was, well, wait a minute, I'm putting an easement on this farm. And they said, no, you're not. We're going to do this, and you're going to do that. And I said, I don't think you get a vote. Last I knew, it was my name on the bottom of the deed. And I want to see it farmed.
So he sold it in 2023 to the American Farmland Trust. The Catskills Agrarian Alliance, the parent organization for West Branch Commons, eventually plans to purchase the land from the trust. Hudson says he hopes to see the land farmed for generations.
This land, really, as you get older, you realize it really does not belong to you. You may have your name on that deed, but it's a temporary holding.
American Farmland Trust Senior Manager Molly Johnson Hack oversees the trust's Farmland for a New Generation program in New York. She says the state's farmland is especially susceptible to overdevelopment.
That farmland is incredibly threatened in New York State, that we are losing farmland at a rapid rate, and that most aging farmers do not have a succession plan. And so those sort of factors combined make it really critical that we work to save the farmland that does exist in New York State so that we can grow food and fiber for New Yorkers.
Let's start with what you're hearing from older farmers or retiring farmers. What are some of those biggest challenges?
So a couple of things that come to mind right off the bat are just needing money for retirement. Older farmers need funds for retirement so that they can retire with dignity and live, you know, hopefully well into their 90s and be able to afford that, have a place to live and be able to support themselves and their families. That most farmers are not going to have a 401k unless they have an off-farm job. And so they really, their wealth is tied up in the land and they need to be able to get cash out of that land in order to retire. So that's a huge piece. And then I think also there's this other piece around there is so much tied up in the land, right? There is this theme around legacy and around, you know, a farmer has worked their whole lives to really build a business and that they're really proud of and their family has grown up there. And it's so much more than just a job that it's really hard, I think, for people to really dig in and figure out that planning process when it feels so personal and it feels so big.
Plus, talking about end of life isn't everyone's favorite thing to do, says Alex Morenci, the Trust's New York Associate for New Generation Program.
It's not a fun thing to talk about. It's not. And sometimes, you know, it's things that are very private for those folks as well. So just the transition and planning and thinking about estate planning is just it feels like this big hurdle a lot of times to get started, but it's really not. But that's one thing we're trying to do is help encourage folks to start earlier because it's a lot easier, you know, when you're starting earlier than waiting until the end or waiting till there's kind of a traumatic life event to kind of start that planning.
Beginning farmers, on the other hand, face different challenges.
The biggest one is being financing, finding an affordable land. And then a piece of that is the financing piece. Land in New York is extremely expensive. And COVID, of course, has kind of started on this trend of, you know, land being even more expensive. And then interest rates are kind of up again right now. So, you know, finding land that's affordable, but also that's going to be able to support our farm business is a huge challenge because you might be able to find more marginal land that's affordable, but it might not be the soils or the things that can support having a good farm business or a viable farm business long term. So finding land, you know, that's affordable, that's a big one. And then I mentioned that financing piece. That comes into play a lot for new and beginning farmers that are looking to pursue financing, especially if they have any sort of federal loan debt, because that automatically disqualifies you from a lot of loans, especially loans through USDA if you have any student loan debt. But then also, if you're putting everything into your farm business, maybe you're leasing land and your all of your income and all of your assets are tied up into that land, you might not have the money to be able to do a down payment or to really get successful financing.
For a project like West Branch Commons, Wright says they're on their way to officially buying the land, but they still have some ways to go.
We are nearing, hopefully, the end of our fundraising process. Our goal is to buy the farm by December 2026. So we have a lot of work to do. Our total fundraising goal is $950,000. $763,000 of that is to buy the farm itself, and then another little bit of money to make the operations go. We have some staffing costs and costs associated with holding the property. So we have raised 60% of that so far, over 60%, through a number of foundations and support through our crowdfunding campaign.
Fundraising those dollars to buy the farm hasn't been easy, says Wright.
The whole atmosphere of, purse strings tightening is affecting foundations as well. So, these routes that we need to be going through in order to make this project work, it's getting more and more difficult, I would say.
But they're hopeful and say building a shared community land trust is a slow process that requires time and shared values. Matias of Serra Vida Farm says watching West Branch Commons evolve is like watching a seed grow.
It's basically like planting a tree. You're planting a seed. You may not see the whole tree bear fruit tomorrow, but it's to be there to tend it along the way. And that's multiple generations. So that's like the way that we think of the commons. It's like we're planting the seed now to provide security, not just for us, not just for me as a pilot farmer and the future pilot like farmers, but for the next generations, to keep the land in perpetuity, to protect the watershed, to create ecological like diversity, and basically restore a lot of the watershed that has been succumbing to speculative market.
They're looking forward to seeing many aspiring farmers come through and learn on the land. In Delancey, I'm Kimberly Izar for Radio Catskill. We'll take a short break, but when we come back, Ronald Kelson digs into a regional buy local campaign.
This week on CatsCast, an historic Catskills hotel abandoned, a hamlet with a tourism economy and a great need for workforce housing, and an opportunity in the making.
The community came together and said, okay, we're going to take a chance. We'll be first in money. We'll take the big risk and get control of the property. And it feels really good.
Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, as part of our expanded hour, we're launching a new regular series with the Pure Catskills campaign. It's a regional by local campaign hosted by the Watershed Agricultural Council. And each month, we're going to hear directly from farmers and business owners and growers in Delaware, Greene, Sullivan, Ulster counties, and the broader region about their businesses. Farming Country producer Ronald Kelson recently spoke with Kristen Morley about the Watershed Agricultural Council, and she gave us a sneak peek into the stories of farmers and growers that we might hear from.
So for those who don't know what Pure Catskills and the Watershed Agricultural Council is, tell us who you are and what you do.
So I'll start with myself. I'm Kristen Morley. I'm the Economic Viability Program Manager for the Watershed Agricultural Council. My role here is to oversee our buy local campaign, which is known as Pure Catskills. The Watershed Ag Council works with farm and forest landowners in the New York City watershed to protect the water supply in a variety of ways that we do that. And Pure Catskills specifically is our campaign to promote the products coming from the region.
any other campaigns that you guys handle that you want to let us know about?
Yeah, so we also, I call it our sister initiative. We have a website called My Woodlot, which is run by our forestry program. And that's for somebody who, you know, is coming to the area or owns lands and they want to learn more about their woods recreationally and or, you know, just taking a walk on public lands. That is a great resource for those that are looking to learn more about the forest side of what we do.
So how did you get to the Watershed Agricultural Council? What's it been like working with Pure Catskills?
Yeah, so I actually grew up in Delhi, New York. I'm from Delaware County and grew up in the watershed my entire life, always driving past the reservoirs. And it wasn't until I was out of college. I was actually an AmeriCorps intern for what we call the Watershed Ag Council as WAC. So I started as an intern about 13 years ago now and have since transitioned into the program manager role probably about 10 years ago or 12, I want to say. So I've been with WAC for a very long time now. And in my tenure, we've just seen such a growth with not just Pure Catskills, but the region as a whole and what it means to be local and bi local. And that's been a really, I think, important part of what I've seen as the Economic Viability Program Manager.
Just to remind folks, we're going to be having the Pure Catskills from the Watershed Ag Council. We're going to have them on monthly here on Farming Country as part of our hour expansion. And we're going to hear from local farmers, local business people, people all over in our listening area. Who and what can we expect to appear in these monthly interviews?
Yeah, so just to deep dive a little bit further into what Pure Catskills actually is, it's a bi-local campaign, but there's an annual membership every single year. And we develop a large 88-page magazine called The Guide to Pure Catskills Products. So during January through March, we are accepting annual membership. And then by Memorial Day weekend, we release our guide. And from there, we do a lot of promotion for our members. So this year, we're just wrapping that up at this point. We're at over 320. I think we're at 326. And those counties cover Delaware, Greene, Otsego, Schoharie, Sullivan, and Ulster. So we have a six-county range. And really, those counties touch the New York City watershed in some capacity with the exception of Otsego. But we are really just a promotional marketing campaign for members in the region in that capacity, really focusing on farm products and forest products. And those tied to that community, whether it's a farmer's market or a restaurant, anyone that is buying locally, supporting locally, you know, you can become a Pure Catskills member. So this year, we are really excited to partner with Radio Catskill as another option for our members. And what we plan on doing is offering this spotlight to members that really cover this region for them to have a chance to vocalize what they do and who they are, because they are the best to be able to do that. We have a website that we dedicate space for our members, and it's pretty comprehensive and you can search a bunch and they're able to tell their stories through our website, but there's nobody better than them and the work, incredible work that they do to provide food for our region on a daily basis.
Do you have any little sneak peeks as to who might be coming up in the next couple months, or can we reveal that?
Well, we're still working on it, but I do know that we're hoping to hit not just the farmers markets, but the farmers and maybe some restaurants or people involved with really the mission of WAC and or Pure Catskills, and hoping that we can provide you guys some great knowledge in that capacity. We're working on the list now, and we are excited to offer this as just another opportunity for our members. We also do a lot of events, so this is just an essentially adding on to that. We sponsor events. We provide tent space at a reduced or free cost for members to attend as well. And we are just really trying to generate sales and bring economic viability to our small producers and our farmers and our forest owners.
Tell us why it's important to you to have local products, whether it's through farming or restaurants or businesses or what else. Why is it important to have an organization like Pure Catskills and the Watershed Ag Council in our area?
It's a great question. I think I should also mention one of the most important components of this is we're actually fully funded this program, Pure Catskills specifically, through New York City DEP. And so in 2004, our farmers got together that were already working within this watershed and receiving additional support. But they said to themselves, how do we brand our products? How do we show that we are the ones providing the water to New York City? And through that, Pure Catskills was born. We've been around for 22 years now, successfully continuing to grow that. And I think the most important thing somebody can do is put dollars back into your own community and knowing where your food comes from. That's really where Pure Catskills was born. And the growth of that, of the knowledge, of the support, and knowing that you can shop really at a farmer's market or at a store at your local farm stand and get most of the items that you need on a daily basis, or even cooking dinner that night, I think is one of the most important things that you can do, especially to keep this region farming. I think that that's one of the most important components of being involved with WAC and with Pure Catskills, is supporting your neighbors and keeping the land farming.
Is there anything else you'd like to let the listener know?
I would like to just let everyone know that you can follow us on Facebook, on Instagram. You can check out our website. We often post where you can buy local products. We do a summer Farmers Market of the Week campaign, and we often will post products that are available throughout the summer seasons. I think we are open to anyone that wants to come to our events or learn more. They can email us at any time. The importance of Pure Catskills and the stories that our members share throughout our guide to Pure Catskills products is really the lifeblood of this region, and supporting farmers and forest landowners in any possible way is really the goal of this program. So I just encourage anyone to reach out at any time, come see us, follow us on social so you know where we'll be. And we just look forward to sharing this time with Radio Catskill for the next couple of months as they expand the Farming Country segment.
That's Kristen Morley, Economic Viability Program Manager at the Watershed Agricultural Council. Just listening to you live right now, our missions could not be more aligned, Farming Country and the Pure Catskills campaign. It's just going to be so great to have all your clients on and lifting them up. And we're just really excited to be working with you.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. Please buy local as much as you can and get out and enjoy the beautiful little Catskills world that we live in. It is a magical place, and we're so fortunate that we can do and be and grow in this region all together and supporting each other. So thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much to Ronald for that conversation. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we head to Narrowsburg to the Tustin Heritage Community Garden.
Recently on Wait Wait, Peter Gross just couldn't understand why it's so hard to get giant pandas to breed.
That's when I do my best work, because the people are watching me, and I have to propagate my species.
I'm Peter Sagal. This week, we'll do our best work while nobody's watching us, because we're on the radio. Join us for the week's news quiz. That's Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Wait Wait, Don't Tell Me, Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Farming Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Well, up next, we are heading to Narrowsburg, where Rosie Starr recently visited the Tustin Heritage Community Garden. member Aaron Fairbanks curated a plot and plan event at the Big Eddie Brewery in Narrowsburg, designed to inspire gardeners early in the growing season. Participants enjoyed tasty local foods and sipped beer while listening to gardening advice. Here's Rosie with more.
When springtime arrives, with warmer weather and longer days, thoughts turn to gardening. Recently, the Tustin Heritage Community Garden hosted a plot and plan garden event. The Big Eddie Brewery in Narrowsburg, New York, offered their space so gardeners in the community could be inspired and hear advice about organic gardening practices in our Upper Delaware River area. Garden member Aaron Fairbanks graciously moderated the presentation by other community garden members, Jeffrey Rose and Annie Stanley.
I'd like to introduce our esteemed panelists, Annie Stanley and Jeffrey Rose. Annie is our fearless leader at the Tustin Heritage Community Garden. I'm going to let her tell you what that is.
So the Tustin Heritage Community Garden is located behind the Western Sullivan Public Library down to Morrow Lane. It's been there for about 16 years. I've been the chair for about 14 years. I think this is my 14th season. It's the longest running green space in Narrowsburg, and I think the longest running green space, public community green space, and community garden in Sullivan County. We have free events throughout the year. It's a member by donation participation. We have a sign-up sheet over there at the entry if you're interested in joining the garden. We might have a few plots available this season. We're waiting for our renewal gardeners to sign up, but please sign up as well for events. We have throughout the season, they're free to the public and the community. We also host the Western Sullivan Public Library Youth Program, and they every season do a Master Gardener certification with the youth, and that is run by Callison Stratton and Dirt Diva. We are officially a pollinator pathway destination on the East Coast. We're also registered with Monarch Watch as an official Monarch way station for monarchs coming through this area in the fall, and also nesting on our milkweed growth that we have there. You have to have a certain amount of plants to qualify to be a Monarch way station, and we did years ago. There's an exterior garden outside of the deer fenced-in garden that is also a public orchard that we planted years ago with Narrowsburg Beautification Group. We also made an entire pollinator garden outside of the fenced-in area that has perennials that support the pollinators and the butterflies. And that was also a collaboration with Narrowsburg Beautification Group, and also highly supported by Sullivan Renaissance, which is now Sullivan 180. Over the years, we've been funded by Sullivan 180, Sullivan Renaissance, the Delaware Scenic Byway, Norcross Wild Foundation, and also public and private donations, member donations. We're also a destination on the Narrowsburg Walking Trail throughout the town as a pollinator destination, but also a destination for humans. It's a beautiful respite there, right, with a great view of the Delaware River, so please check it out.
So Jeffrey runs Wild Yarrow Nursery, and I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about what you specialize in and kind of how you landed there and how it impacts you as a gardener.
Okay. I used to work for Silver Heights Nursery for Trina Pilonero. She was my mentor. She retired some years ago. I didn't have the resources to buy out her farm, but she helped me get started. This is now my 10th year since I opened up my nursery in Coshecton. What I specialize in, we grow just about everything from seed. Everything is grown from seed. I try to source organic seed whenever I can. We don't use any chemicals at the nursery at all. I use a very, very small amount of inputs to manage pests and things. I think we're going to get into some of that later. But I try to bring diversity to the garden. So we have over 120 varieties of heirloom tomatoes. We have lots of different herbs, medicinal herbs, dyeing herbs, native plants, interesting annual flowers. I think the more diversity you have in your garden, the more varied an insectary you're going to draw in, better good insects. The diversity is the better for everything. We try to bring that out at Wild Arrow Farm.
Jeffrey, I think sometimes getting started for this season or for the first time, it can feel just like a little overwhelming. What would you say are some of like your top recommendations for like what is important to think about at the beginning of a season or at the beginning of a garden?
I'd say the three most important things are what's your motivation? Which, do you plan to grow enough for canning? Are you just growing for a salad? Are you growing just to have some flowers? Figure out what you really want to do. Then the next thing is, how much time are you going to really have? I've seen some gardeners bite off a little more than they can chew. It all looks great in April and May, but then June comes around and the weeds are tall and the work gets a lot harder and you've got to keep up with it. So figuring out, are you going to be able to spend a couple hours a week, every single week, making sure your weeding gets done? You know, the weeding, people complain about it, but honestly, if you don't like weeding, you don't really like gardening. It's a big part of gardening. And that's when you're in there with your plants and you can find if there's something diseased or if there's an insect problem. If you're in there every few days or at least once a week, you're going to find these things and be able to take care of them. And then it's the scope. How much space do you have? And then you have to address the rodent and deer problem. Now, we've battled this forever at the nursery, and the 8-foot fence is critical. It wasn't enough. They were still getting through, either breaking through the plastic, or I once saw a deer jump over the 8-foot fence from a standstill right next to it. Jumped up. It didn't land well. It wasn't good for the deer. I was chasing him out of the garden. He'd gotten in through a breach somewhere. And then 2 years ago, we added an electric fence around outside of that. So far, I've been deer-free. So that'll take care of the deer. And then around our vegetable and flower gardens, we have some chicken wire. So that we're inside the 8-foot fence and the electric. And then I have another barrier of a 3-foot chicken wire that's also buried down and out a little bit. So that keeps them out. And then for the bugs, speaking of pollinators, I find it's very valuable to leave a wild border around your vegetable gardens. Let some of the natural mustards and plants that the bugs would have if you weren't there. If you mow the lawn right up to your beautiful vegetable garden, the insects are going to end up right into your vegetable garden. If you let the weeds and the grasses grow up around your chicken wire fence, maybe a foot or so on each side, and let that go completely wild, you can help give them what they want without giving them what you want. And I think that's been really helpful. So those are things that I would think about first. And start small. Don't overdo it. Start with something you know you're going to manage.
Annie encourages making less waste in the garden and making compost for garden soil.
It's good every spring early to till in some kind of compost or manure into your garden. You can also do it in the fall. We started letting our garden go a little bit in the fall, not doing like a major cleanup because we wanted to support the birds and insects throughout the winter. So we're tending to like till in manure and compost in the early spring. It's good to do a rotation of crops as well. Different plants that you rotate will need different things out of your soil every season. Some of the stuff that you leave in the fall to let to go to compost, like sunflowers and stuff, can be really great to decompose in your soil.
How do I know like what to plant and when to plant it?
There's some basic times for planting, right? There's stuff that you plant as early as April and May, the beginning of May. And then there's stuff you have to wait until after the frost date, which is generally considered to be around Memorial Day, right? So earlier, you can plant onions and shallots and leeks. You can put in some lettuce and kale. Poppies do best when you plant them in April. We get 4 foot tall poppies at the nursery because I start them in January and I put them out in April.
For a pollinator specific garden, how does that impact what you choose to plant or what you choose not to plant?
It is really important to have pollinator friendly plants and flowers in your garden, otherwise your vegetables won't really do well. Our garden definitely did better when we had flourishing flower gardens all around. And it's not just the bees that pollinate, it's all the butterflies and the little flies and the wasps. And I find that you can do companion planting in your plot too that won't take up a lot of space, that can also help your tomatoes and your beans.
Learn to live with failures in the garden. What does garden success look like?
If you have a 75% success rate in your garden, you are absolutely winning. It is great. You should be very happy with that. Because different things are going to fail every year. There's different inputs every year, different weather patterns, different insects, different rodents, different fungi, all kinds of things are happening out there. And so you're going to get something different, a different result every year.
The Tustin Heritage Community Garden has an Instagram and Facebook page. You can write to TustinHCG@gmail.com. Check out their garden events throughout the season. One Grand Books on Main Street in Narrowsburg, New York, has copies of garden books to inspire you. Squarefoot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew is highly recommended. Squarefoot Gardening is a book based on the principle that uses less space and less work. Wild Yarrow Farm and Plant Nursery is located in Coshecton on New Turnpike Road. Their website is wildyarrowfarm.net. The Delaware Farm and Garden Supply is in Calicoon. As you know, extensive information can be found online. Check out Delaware Highlands Conservancy in Wayne County, the Penn State Extension, and Cornell Cooperative Extension. All of those organizations have seasons of experience.
Thanks so much to Rosie and the Tustin Heritage Community Garden for that conversation. Before we sign off, just a few things happening in the community. Today, April 18th, the Catskill Fly Fishing Center and Museum will host a Fly Tires Rendezvous. That'll be from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. It's a full day of fly tying, but you can watch skilled artisans at work. You yourself can pick up new techniques when it comes to fly tying. And also keep in mind that next week we're actually going to have a story on fly tying and you know, the art and artistry behind it. So definitely stay tuned for that. And on April 22nd, which is also Earth Day, the Sullivan County Audubon Society will have their spring meeting. The topic is going to be the monarch butterfly migration. You can find more information and more events on our community calendar on our website at wjffradio.org. And that's all for this week's show. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Sign up for Radio Catskill's free weekly newsletter. Get the latest local news, culture, and things to do in your inbox every Friday. Stay connected and informed with Radio Catskill's newsletter. Subscribe at wjffradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill.